I'm expecting.
Welcome to the Reinvent Health podcast, where we explore the stories, science, and soul of what it means to live well. My guest today is Krista Gumede-Buthelezi, the remarkable author of Ubizo, a deeply moving exploration of ancestral calling, identity, and the courage it takes to step into your truth. Krista's voice has resonated far beyond the pages of a book. She's also the newly appointed editor of Odyssey magazine, bringing her insights on spirituality and personal transformation to a community that's been celebrating conscious living for over four decades. In this conversation, we talk about what it means to answer your calling, how to navigate that inner tug between who you've been and who you're becoming, and why connecting with our roots might just be the key to modern wellness. If you're feeling that quiet nudge to slow down and listen, this might just be your sign. So let's start with a big one. What is Ubizo really about? What's beneath the storyline, and what was the call you were personally answering when you wrote it?
Ubizo means the calling. I grew up, obviously, in the United States. The joke now is that I landed on the northeast coast of the wrong continent, the wrong country. But I have all my life wanted to be in South Africa. And granted, you know, most Americans even today, but certainly back then, don't even understand that South Africa is a separate place from Africa or how that goes. So for a little girl to know that at a young age, you know, was rather unusual. The book is my answer to the always asked question, how did you end up here?
Yeah.
You know, I at the time that I began writing it, I was living in the very rural Lubumbo Mountains up near Mkuzi and Jozini near Eswatini, Swaziland.
Yeah.
And I stick out like a sore thumb. So the question was asked on a pretty regular basis, and I got tired of answering it. So I was lazy. That's why I wrote the book.
Uh-huh.
And also, I think to help myself make sense of a lot of twists and turns in my life prior to coming here. And what, all jokes aside, the real answer I wanted to give people was what had happened to me that I would make this kind of a leap to follow a calling, which is a rather wispy, hard to define, hard to hold on to, non-tangible thing.
Yeah.
Powerful, but not something that's really honored in our general society.
Would you call Ubizo a spiritual awakening? And before we even, in fact, let's step back. Let's talk about what brought you. You've sort of aired on it sort of briefly, but what really called you to Africa? What were the steps that preceded your journey to arriving on this continent?
I grew up in a predominantly Caucasian area of the U.S. called New England,
uh-huh.
which is I am genetically, my mom's side is mostly Pilgrim and maybe some Indian, depending on who you ask. So there were not a whole lot of people of color. There were some. And things were not ideal in my childhood. Whenever I saw someone at the grocery store, whatever, with darker skin, I would literally run up and hug them around the knees, which appalled my very fear-based, very, I mean, prejudice doesn't begin to explain it to parents, but it was all based in fear.
Okay.
So it started young. It started young. I did not feel like I belonged. I did not feel like I belonged in this skin. As I grew, I read like National Geographics, you know, as if it were an addiction, and I would immediately go in every issue and look for stories of Africa. I could smell the dirt. I could feel how Africa felt.
Wow.
I don't know. You know, if you believe in past lives, that's the easiest explanation.
Sure.
And And I would find out much later, after I had come here for a month and when I went back for a month, I would find out from a much older cousin that I had, when I was 4.5 years old, asked to go visit him at varsity and asked him to take me to the library to find a book to teach me how to read Zulu, because I had already learned how to read English. You know, there are many Americans today who still don't know what Zulu is, other than, they think it's something like voodoo, kind of one of those made-up words. So I didn't find that out until after my first trip here. But anyway, so it goes back to when I was 4.5, as far as we know. I always felt more at home with people of color, still do. And not and African American culture is an entirely different thing than African culture.
Yes.
I, yes, I did do still feel more at home in that arena, but there was still something lacking, and I knew it. So there's just sort of always been this yearning in me, this feeling of never being home, of never belonging. Ironically, I feel much more at home sitting on a mat at in a funeral or an indaba or wedding or whatever, up in rural Zululand than I do anywhere else in the world, and I've traveled pretty widely. So that is part of the calling. What I'm living into now, and what the second book, which I don't think I'll be allowed to use a Zulu word by the publishers, but I would love to call Vuka or Siya Vuka, Siza Vuka, We Will Wake Up, We Will Rise. Being here has allowed me to fully awaken, which I think my calling is really about, and then to sort of tell about it, tell the stories of it. I think people learn best from stories. So by telling my story, my entire point, if I have one, is just to let people see what is possible, because we're taught to keep really narrow blinders on, and there's so much more possible in this world.
So there's a couple of questions here. One is, we ignore the calling, all of us, but many of us have a calling and we put it on the back burner our whole lives. And yes, for a lot of people, the calling starts in childhood, but we don't know what it is as children unless we've got very conscious parents, which is very unusual. But there were some steps along the way, and we spoke about this when we chatted earlier, but it's also in your book. There were some very prominent figures in your life, people from Africa, and I'd love for you to go into the details because it's an incredible story that pushed and nudged and wangled you down the path to finally arriving in your spiritual home. Can you tell us about that story at the White House and who you met and that I think it's when we like to call it when you don't listen to the whispers, the universe yells. And I think it was yelling at you that day. So let's describe for our listeners what happened.
Well, it's interesting because that yelling part, it's interesting you say that because that shows up. I'll make sure I cover that in this telling of the story. I don't always emphasize that part. And yes, absolutely, that's true. I was a hard nut to crack, literally a couple of big brain injuries and a broken neck. My former husband is with a large defense contractor, and part of his job required us to go to a lot of events in Washington, D.C. Black tie events 4 nights a week, not unusual. And there one in particular, and as his spouse, that was, very much, I was required to be there. One of them that I enjoyed very much is there's a concert for the president yearly. It is held in June and they televise it on 4th of July, on Independence Day. It's a long weekend event. So there is all day Saturday. I'm trying to remember if there was something Friday night. I don't think so. All day Saturday, there's a rehearsal for the stars. You go behind the Senate, public areas and meet. I spent Saturday night talking to Dick Van Dyke, who was a childhood just icon for me and sort of what I modeled what a father should be on, it should be on his Dick Van Dyke show. So that was really exciting. And this happens to me. People all think that they know me. You know, I've got one of those faces people think of familiar, and I do have a tendency to meet famous people. So my friends were just, you know, on Sunday they were giving me a hard time about being Dick Van Dyke's new best friend. Spent some time with Smokey Robinson, you know, all
Wow.
that. As one does, Robin Robinson
As
was
one
there
does.
too, as one does. And there are many, many for this concert. There are different celebrities every year. So there's a big thing at the White House, a ceremony. It was President Obama, Michelle Obama. And then afterwards, in the White House downstairs, there's a very large, wide passage. And on either side, there's a very big reception room, and then the ladies' toilets on the right. And on the men's side, there's another lounge, big lounge, and the men's room. So we were in this large hallway gathered, or we were about to go to Ford's Theater for the concert. And a friend came up, a coworker of my husband's came up to me and said, "Well, I'm not Dick Van Dyke's new best friend, but guess who I just met?" I said, "I don't
Oh.
know who." And he said, "Archbishop Desmond Tutu." Now, he knew in that circle I was considered a raging liberal. And so he knew that Tutu was, you know, someone I admired. And I said, "Where?" And he said, "In the men's room." And I was like, you know, and I'm in a black tie, you know, whole long dress and the hair and the makeup, all that kind of thing. And well, I'll go in a men's room at a football game or a concert. Didn't think that was going to go over well that day. So he said, no, come. He's in the lounge outside." So we went into the lounge on the men's side, and there's an area. There was a photographer snapping pictures of Desmond Tutu with people. And I noticed that everyone wanted just a picture taken with him, that they weren't talking to him. And I thought to myself, well, I'd much rather have a conversation with him. You know, I like conversations. So I kind of leaned against this wall in this little alcove, and my eyes were kind of blurry. You know, I was tired. It was a long weekend, and I was just sort of observing. And you know how when someone approaches you, even if you're not focused, you feel it. I could feel him coming towards me. And I looked up, and he's walking towards me, and there's a wall behind me. There's no, he can't be going anywhere else. And he came up to me, and he held my hands in front of him and said, "My dear friend, it is so good to see you again." And I said, "It's nice to see you too." Because what else say?
What else can you say?
And he said, "How funny we should meet here in this White House. And, you know, how are you? And what is the name they call you by this time?" Those are his exact words.
Oh.
And I said, "Krista, oh, Krista, what a perfect name for you. It's one who brings light." And, you know, the last time we were together, I was not able to bless you. Is it all right if I bless you today here in this White House?" And I said, "Sure." And this original friend's wife had come up and was standing next to us watching the whole thing. And I tried to introduce him, and he said, "No, we must do the blessing now." So he said, "Hello, it's nice to meet you. We're doing a blessing," as in, like, take a hike. So she stepped back. I don't remember anything he said. She told people that she thought a lot of it was in African. I do remember he used to wear those purple shirts with that wonderful weave, and I remember that almost vibrating. I remember how it felt. I'll never forget. And then it was over, and he said, "Well, when are you coming to? You have not been yet to South Africa, have you?" And I said, "No, I've tried." And he said, "Well, when are you coming?" And I said, "You know, well, I've tried. I got cancer one time, so this is your point about I got cancer one time and couldn't come, and I can't remember. I had to have some sort of major surgery." And you know, and he said, "Well, you will come because now the time is right. It is time for you to come home. And when you come, if Mrs. Tutu and I are in Cape Town, then you will come and have dinner with us. And if not, I do want you to meet this my friend Michael. You two are pods in a pea." I will never forget. He said, "Pods in a pea.
Hudson a
Pods in a
P.
pea." And I said, "All right." And so we must have a photograph. And you've seen in the book, there's the photo of the two of us. And that was that. The rest of the evening and the concert, you know, I met Maya Angelou that night, And I was sitting next to, a very prominent Washington wife, the whole, it was quite all of that. But he would turn around and he would wink at me and smile in this Ford's Theater. And he would point, no, like at me, not at the celebrity people, I was sitting next to. It was very, very funny. And then I didn't see him again until I came to South Africa a few years later. And he recognized me. Even he was just gotten out of hospital. It was his first service that he did on a Friday at St. George's. And I was sitting next to, he was in his throne, and I was sitting on the ground next to him, and he looked down and he said, "You came home. You did it." And he told me he was decrepit because he didn't remember my name. And I reminded him and I said, "Bubba, you're not decrepit. You've lived such a life. You've done so much." And he told me and my friend that it was, he would not be with us much longer. He did live a few years longer. And that it was time for us to carry it forward. The name of my coaching business in the US was Carry It Forward.
Okay, just way too much going on there. It's almost ridiculous. And then you can't ignore that. I mean,
No,
what were your next steps?
you cannot.
What
That you cannot ignore.
this you cannot ignore.
No. Look, I lived a very good life. My ex-husband was an excellent provider in that sense. We lived inside the Beltway in a beautiful home. I had the big diamond ring, the Mercedes, everything that I was told would make me happy, and I wasn't. And I had
And so
also,
often the case.
yeah, I had also been sick a lot. And not just happy, not happy, but like really not well. On any front. So I started to dream. I started to have this series of dreams about, it's almost time. It's getting to be time. It's time. So as he said, I would know when it was time. And I literally had dreams about it. Guides and ancestors and things. And so there were sort of steps that were set out for me. It wasn't just, okay, you have to move to South Africa. How are you going to do it? There were certain steps that were set out. I had to deal with, the fact that my marriage was not thriving or anything close to it, that I had done everything I could. I had to, my daughter at that time was just getting ready to go to varsity. So, make sure she was settled and all of that. There were just a series of steps, but this time I listened and I responded at the utmost of my ability at that time. And, the 2.5, 3 years went by really fast. I came here for a month and then went back for a month and came here and back and stayed.
The question that comes to mind at the moment is, was your childhood particularly religious or spiritual?
Both. Intentionally religious. I grew up in the Lutheran Church. I switched to Presbyterian when I was an adult. I'm actually an ordained elder in the Presbyterian Church, and I was about to become an interdenominational minister before I came here. I was about to enter a program. So, yes. However, my father did not, who's raised Catholic, did not go to church and was had a lot of trouble with church politics and things. So I had kind of a different point of view at home. Also, things at home did not at all match what I was taught in church or how my family was expected to act in church. And so that was something. I read the Bible 4 times before I was 12 years old, looking for, like, what am I missing? There was neglect and abuse on every level, and two very lost people in the parental positions. I don't blame them, but it was quite a interesting setup, and
I can imagine.
it did make me extremely compassionate. I mean, anyone can tell me anything. I can hold space for anything, and I'm grateful to my parent. My parents did not have great lives. One is alive but lost in dementia, and the other has died recently. I'm grateful to them for teaching me everything that I needed to know, but it can't have been a very fun lifetime for them. Then, spiritually, that just came naturally to me. Because things were the way they were, my best guess is that my ancestors showed up even in New England in the US, where there is no cultural setup for that, or structure. Because things were, I needed someone. So I thought everyone had, I called them the old people. I thought everyone had old people. But when I got old enough and I just casually would mention them, I would literally get beaten. My mom's family goes all the way back to Salem and the witch trials, and there is a deep, deep fear of anything outside, the orchestrated, when I talk about narrow blinders, there's a very narrow field that I was supposed to believe in. And I've questioned, I was a seeker for a very long time, and from the time I was a child. So both, both.
It is difficult to reconcile Christianity with African spirituality. How do you manage to do that? I mean, it sounds to me like you just said your elders showed up from the beginning. So it was probably quite a simple transition for you. You could see where the paths interlinked, but how do you nowadays reconcile the two?
So I ancestors were around when I was young. I believe they're always around, but I was in interaction with them when I was young, and then literally I was taught in the most brutal ways not to do that. So I went very Lungu American, and it was the late 70s and early 80s that I came of age. So sex, drugs, rock and roll, the whole thing. A lot of self-medicating, a lot. I tried that for a while. I tried the psychological stuff for a while, and then the ancestors came back when I was mismedicated and got flooded with all the trauma memories and became suicidal. So when I was literally in hospital, they came back, and that was in my late 30s. So there was a big gap, probably close to 30-year gap that I wasn't really practicing in that regard. And I that was when I went through my very Christian phase. The reconciling. So Baba Wam, my father, the Gumedi in my name is for Baba, comes from a long line of African, traditional African healers. But also believed in what I think of as true Christianity, the real precepts of Christianity. And so we shared that. In fact, when he died, I was the eldest child, so that's my place. But he told everyone that I should do the service because I believed exactly what he believed. And so we did include both. I think there's Christianity with a small c and there's Christianity with a large c. And that's true of Judaism, and that's probably true Hindu, Muslim, it's probably true across the board. Religion can be used to con canon is used to control people. It can also be a sanctuary and certainly a community. I am extremely fond of the Old Testament. The Bible, a lot of it, as was my father, and of the Gnostic Gospels, for sure. Just the fact that the Gnostic Gospels were taken out, that right there maimed Christianity, in a way that and allowed it to control people in a way that I don't think was ever intended. There's that telephone game, Nikki, that you play when you're kids and the message goes around the circle. The Bible was written by human beings. But the basic precepts and the basic understandings are really similar, actually, between African spirituality. And the same thing has happened with African spirituality, in the initially probably by colonization, but it's been carried forth by African, Black African people as well. In my work that I do with ancestors, with people, the ancestors often weep because they believed that converting their families to Christianity, and more importantly, I don't have trouble with that. It's the renouncing the traditional ways that I have trouble with. That
Yeah.
caught, well, it's not, it doesn't matter if I have trouble, that has caused problems. They, in giving that up, they gave up something that I believe all human beings need, is that tie to those who have come before us, those
Yeah.
whose shoulders we rise from. And I think that's just a basic human need, just like I think looking at the moon more often than not is a basic human need to know that we're not alone. So much suffering in this world has to do with belonging or feeling that you don't belong. That certainly was a lot of
Yeah.
suffering for me. And these are ancient ways, and you can go to any indigenous culture and find the same precepts in them. And
Yeah.
to have lost them is also a form of control. Anything can be used, for good or for evil, for shadow or for light. So
Yes.
long answer, but I think it's well worth pointing out that it's much simpler than most people make it.
Most things in life are, we do overcomplicate,
Yes. Yeah.
unfortunately. Yeah. So you had the calling to follow the path less followed, for want of a better description. And
Yes.
then you had a calling to write a book. And that is an exercise in vulnerability. It can be risky, especially when you're naming names and you're talking about your past, and you're not going to change the names to preserve the ego of those who might feel slighted. And I know, because I've written books myself, what did you have to confront in order to bring Obizo to life?
I keep swearing that I'm never going to write another memoir. I'm going to write fiction. I have all these fiction book ideas that I keep writing down, but this is what I'm called, there's what I'm comfortable with, and then there's what I'm called to do. Those are two very different things. And I'm writing a second book now about, I knew when I finished Ubizo and kind of tied it up with a bow, I knew that bow wasn't really, but that's where it needed to leave for there.
Yeah.
It's not easy. I did change some names. The writer Annie Lamott, I'm going to kind of butcher the quote, but basically she has said that your story is yours to tell. If people
Yes.
didn't want you to write about them badly, then they should have treated you better. And
Exactly what I would say.
I had that on a sticky note on my computer, the whole time I was writing, particularly the childhood stuff.
Yeah.
Now my parents are, I feel at peace with their on a soul level. One is caught in an in-between world, and one is gone, and it has come to light that probably. My father was not actually my biological father, and my biological
Wow.
father died. They've died 6 months apart, interestingly.
Uh-huh.
So it felt like an okay time. I started writing the childhood part a long time ago, more as catharsis for me. And that's the thing about memoir you have to be really careful about, I think, is you have to write it from a place of equanimity and of balance and where you are. You can write it at any point, and it is very cathartic, and it's a very, very good thing. I think writing is an excellent practice for clearing things and for self-discovery. But it wasn't, it's not easy. I'm a Libra rising. Like, fairness is really, really important to me. So
Yeah.
some people say that I've been more than fair to some of the people in the book. And that's my prerogative. I don't think anyone comes to this life and says, "Let me find a woman and who looks like this and treat her really badly." And it like no one let's have our first baby be a child that we take all of our stuff out on. No one like is born and thinks that. Life takes us on a journey. And I think we all have whether you want to call it a calling or a mission, there's a reason we came. There are things to work out. And the Native American cultures, there's an idea that generations of a family come for seven generations to work on jealousy or love or whatever. You know, however you theorize it, there's a reason we're all here. There's a reason we find each other. And there's a lot of growing that you can't do by yourself. I did a hell of a lot of therapy, but there's a lot of growth you can only do in relationship. And so I wanted to write in a way that both expressed what happened truthfully and conveyed my gratitude for the role these people played in my own development.
What has following your heart, but also the ability to write your story done for your health?
I am 64 years old and almost a half. And I am certainly happier, certainly more at peace, and definitely healthier than I've ever been. I was, as you know, I was nearly killed by poisoning a few years ago. That's what the new book is about. So that has re that required basically 2 years in bed. Mostly, and a lot of treatment, and that continues at a, to a lesser degree. And I don't think without that happening that I was doing fine before. I don't think I would have done the deep diving that this is required without it. I have come to believe that most health issues are energetic in nature, that most of it comes from holding on to everything and not releasing things because we're taught, right? Or consumer, I want to society, but bigger than that, human, a race of consumptive human beings. We're taught that that's the, you know, the person who has the most toys at the end wins. I had a lot of toys before I came here. I live a far less comfortable lifestyle. And for me, that's far better. It's far better. I've let go of a lot. And the more I let go, the healthier I am. And the other root of physical suffering, as well as emotional and psychological suffering, that I've really seen clearly is what we believe. My name when I was a little girl, I think it's in the book, was Gretchen. My mother's nickname for me, which she used frequently, was Gretch the Wretch.
Really?
Really? So I didn't, that was just my normal. You know, we all have a preset of normal. It's like if you find adults who are raised in foster care, or children of alcoholics or addicts, there are a lot of commonalities. It's because of how we were wired, especially before 7 years old. So I thought that was normal. When I was in hospital and doing a group session or something, which I'd never done and haven't really done since, I mentioned that just off the cuff, you know, the scratch of the wretch thing, and everyone sort of went, what? Like you did. But that was my normal. So I actually changed my name when I left the hospital because I had so many tapes with that name. I hated the song. What is the hymn that saved a wretch like me? Anyway, there's a famous hymn that has a line in it that saved a wretch like me. People love that hymn, and I could never hear it because of that. And, you know, it's funny because I woke up the other day. And I realized how much, as I have, I mean, this comes in layers. I know this intellectually, but it hit me on a much deeper level that I wasn't the wretch that my mother was, that she was projecting that onto me. There's a thing called transference. I was the oldest daughter. It's all psychologically makes sense. So I've always been an inordinately grateful person, just innately. It's not, I don't, that's, I'm not a brag or anything. It's just who I am. I live in awe. That is the place I live best. And that, so I first realized at 37, I'm 64. That's just one example of how things hold on to us. People believe I'm not an artist. You know, it can be that simple kind of thing. We're all creative. We all need to be creative. It's that's how we experience consciousness. There are so many examples I could give you, but that's two.
A question I get asked a lot, I'm sure you do as well, is what does it take to change? And in your case, extreme suffering and illness, car accident. I mean, you described a tire blowing out, cancer, poisoning. I mean, from my own journey, nothing nearly as extreme as yours, but it does take some kind of pain and suffering before we pay attention. Do you think this is an unavoidable rite of passage for the human condition, that we have to feel the pain before we start looking for other ways to live?
I hope not.
Good answer.
But that is, I would like to believe that it's not necessary, but it is normal.
It is normal.
As I said, I was a very tough nut to crack. So that tire blowing thing, I was on the N2 coming home from Durban. I had a Prado at the time because I lived in the bush and needed a strong vehicle. And my front left tire blew and I lost control. And it was nighttime on the, very rural part of the N2. So very, very dark, no moon. I spun and I spun and I spun. I finally get control of the steering wheel and I looked up and I was about to run into the side of an 18-wheeler truck. And, in my headlights. And I prayed in isiZulu, interestingly. It just came out. And I picked up my feet. I do remember that. I remember my body going into kind of fetal position and my feet being picked up. And there was a lot of sound and everything got very slow-mo. And I landed in between two of the biggest trees along the N2. Most of the trees in the N2 wouldn't do you any damage. We would find out later, my tire tracks looked like I was going to go into this massive tree. This has been between Sisui and Mkuzi. But I went next to it instead, between two. And the driver, was Zulu and came to me and, wuzza, 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 and get out. My glasses were thrown to the back of the vehicle. We didn't find them for a long time. It was a thing. The whole side of the Prado came off.
Good heavens.
And where my feet were was completely crushed, but I had picked up my feet. And I walked out. I climbed out over that center console, which is not easy because it was my side that I hit. And people could not believe the wreckage was there for, I don't know, 24 hours or so. So everyone up there is big news, all that. People stopped. We had called an ambulance. I didn't want to go to Richards Bay. I wanted to go to the local Haas Bethesda up there because I knew them. People I did not know who were white because everyone there was Zulu because that's the people that I was close to around there. My brother, sister-in-law, everyone was there, other brothers. And these people who I didn't know would peek in and say, "Do you want me to call your husband?" And do you, and my partner was on the way, so he's behind me. And do you want us to do what was it? Do you want us to call your family? And I said, "This is my family." Just sort of backed out of the ambulance. It was very funny. So there was a very strong, even as dazed as I was, there was this very strong opportunity for me to make clear where I stood that, again, things happen that don't even make sense. And no one believes. I had to go around and make rounds of the churches for 4 Sundays in a row so that they could see that I was alive and okay. You know, I was bumped up and bruised up and cut a little bit, but that was about it. I was
Oh,
out of the
very cool.
hospital by daybreak. So I think it depends on, you know, I clearly came here. I mean, no one, you know, when I tell people starting over does not mean moving across the universe to a completely different culture. And, you know, you don't have to do it the way I did.
Yeah.
But you do have to pay attention. And I think everyone, it's just like medicine, everyone gets the dose that they need to get. I ignored a lot, to go back to my previous point, because of my beliefs, because I was so, as a child who felt they were not loved or wanted and did not belong, and landed in a place that they really didn't belong in a bigger sense, but in my family. And was told that I was broken and I was sick and all of these kinds of things and wretched from day one. And that, you know, they never wanted me to be born and that I was only born to take care of other people. I internalized and I believed all that. So I had a lot to get rid of. Not everyone does. Not everyone does. But I do strongly recommend paying attention to synchronicities. That's the lightest version and the most beautiful version, synchronicities, and to coincidences and to really to not medicate yourself, because this is the control thing. We are medicated to the point that we can't get the lesson out of it. But to find ways, whether you write it out, you talk it out with someone, doesn't have to be a professional, just someone who's compassionate, you know. Because underneath it all, what we all come here, I believe, to learn is that we must love ourselves before we can love anyone else.
I agree.
You can't be compassionate with other people if there's not self-compassion. Not really, truly. We put on a good show of it. And it just depends on how fast you learn that lesson. It's not punitive. It's what's needed. And I think what you signed up for, like, I think this being human on planet Earth is in the, you know, if we're looking at it as a game or something, you know, in the universe, is probably considered an extreme sport. And only, you know, just to be here in any way is quite
Exactly.
an act of courage.
It
And it's
really is.
probably, you know, it's like, you can either put on Retin A on your skin, or you can go and have your face redone completely. This is beyond having your face redone completely, you know. Or you know, on the other end is you can eat really well, and so your face, you know, your skin's good. This is extreme, 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 and this is it, knowing that you chose it and taking that self responsibility. I don't know if it's true or not. This is just the story that, you know, comes to me. We all have different ways of trying to explain this. But if you take that self-responsibility and you understand that you chose it and you can look at it as a hell of a ride versus a trial to be born over and over, it's a lot more fun.
The reframe is really powerful.
Really powerful.
So I believe everyone listening to this episode is listening for a reason. Something in them drove them to play this podcast today. What could you gift every listener? One question to ask themselves to help them get closer to their own truth. What would it be?
If you are here, you were meant to be here, and you belong.
Love that. Love that. Krista, where can people find your book?
They can find it's Ubizo, Ubizo, A Story of Coming Home. It is in South Africa, available through Takealot and through my website, which is KristaGumediButhelezi.com.
I have a
And
version on Kindle, so you can definitely get it on
exactly.
Kindle.
And across the world, it's available through Amazon. You should also be able to order it abroad through independent bookstores. There's an outlet for that, but in South Africa, that doesn't seem to be true.
Okay. Yeah, I can highly recommend getting a hold of a copy of your book. I think we chatted last week and I'm almost done reading it. It is a it's not I wouldn't say it's an easy read. It's a challenging read, but it reads easily, if that makes sense. It's almost unputdownable. So for anybody on a journey who has felt the glimmer of a calling and who feels like they need to find their tribe, this is a really good place to start. And start now because the second book is coming as well. When is the next book coming through?
I think there's a chance that it will be out by the end of 2026. I think there's a strong
Brilliant.
chance.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
Brilliant.
sometimes later 2026.
Right.
And we'll be doing it. We haven't really been talking about this, but we'll do breaking news for you. I am currently now the editor and curator for Odyssey Magazine, and we have started Odyssey Books Press. So it will be coming out through Odyssey
Yay.
Books. I'm happy to say that.
Amazing. Krista, thank you so much for sharing your journey today. I can't wait to get this out. And see what the response is. I think it's going to resonate for many, many people. So thank you for being brave enough again to share your wisdom and your story with us.
Thanks, Nikki. I am, thank you for what you do and what you bring to the world. I'm happy to
Thank
be
you.
part of it.
Thank you for joining us today on the Reinvent Health Podcast. If this episode resonated with you, take a moment to share it with someone who's searching for meaning or maybe struggling to hear their own inner voice. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. And until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and keep reinventing what wellness means for you.